idea was to have a course here for a few weeks that would prepare us for Rosh Hashanah. And I think Aram Hofstein has organized lectures, shirim on the machzor and the davening and various practical aspects that a person needs to know. And maybe in the next few weeks, Mr. Shem will cover some of the details of tshuva, how you work on correcting things, that mistakes you made in the past, which we have discussed together in detail over the last few years. But I thought we could start with something in the spiritual or more mystical realm, unless anyone has any objections. Let me try and describe a picture of a spiritual subject that we need as background for entering the period of trying to get close again to the spiritual root, which is what Rosh Hashanah is about, or Elul anyway, the month of drawing close. Let's see if we can try and study the subject together. Not easy at all, and likely to misunderstand it because we have very serious misconceptions about the spiritual world. But let's see if we can make sense out of it. Give me a while to maybe lay down some basics, and then, as usual, Sunday night we try to set aside for discussion. So if something's not clear, then please feel free to ask. The principle, the axiom, the principle by which the spiritual world, they're very, very hard to say this, that they're very few, very hard to find the words to describe these things, because we're speaking in concrete, finite, clear words about things that are completely abstract. So it's very hard to find a way to say it, but something like this. The concept we have is that the world that we see, the world that we live in, is just the outermost layer of a system of reality. It's the level that is most explicit, but it's furthest away from the root of the source. Let's try and understand that. What we want to get to grips with is our perception of the world and how we could use it to make an effect to change the spiritual root. That means the root of yourself and the root of the cosmic structure. They're both interrelated. So the principle again is like this, that there's a system of interconnected levels of reality. The highest level, or the most real if you like, in absolute terms, is what we call the divine level, what we call Hashem. The different levels in that reality also that the Kabbalists talk about, but be that as it may, that as high as we're allowed to think anyway, we have some level that we call Hashem's name, let's say Hashem. Below that, there starts to be manifest an infinite number of worlds, each one that drives the one below it, or imprints its pattern on the one below it, until we arrive at this one. They're all exact replicas, except translated into the version, or the currency if you like, or the voltage of that particular level. When you get down here, there's almost nothing left. Right? When you get down here, what you have is an exact replica of the higher levels, except with almost all the energy taken out. Is anyone with me? The way it's put in Kabbalistic writing is that it's like filters. Each level is like a new filter that's been put in. What's been put in the way is not something new, it's something that keeps the new creation at each level is just a block. There's no new level created. What's created is just a new filter. And because there's a darkening of the light at that level, so you see something new. Are you with me? The reason you see colors is because each time you put a filter in front of light, what happens is you filter out all the colors. Do you know what a red filter is? A red filter is just something that keeps out all the other wavelengths. So you see red, but it's not something that makes red. It's something that blocks everything else. Are we together? And if you put even enough filters in the way, you see black. Because you don't have any light left. And the color of this world is black. In spiritual terms. Spiritually. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Spiritually. Yes. The Kabbalistic color is black. It corresponds to black. If you look at the colors that are... Yes? Fair enough? There's just enough light left here to see that it's black.
The world is open in front of the eyes.
In the physical world. In the physical world, yes. In the physical, in the analogy of the physical world, the reason you see green is because the green object reflects that light well and absorbs the others. Or, right? Or if you put a filter, you wear green sunglasses, it filters the other colors. That's why you see green. Correct? I'm not talking Kabbalistically. That's just pure physics. Okay. What? Yes, physical. In the spiritual world, you have the parallel of that. That as the reality comes down, it's shielded and shaded until it drops its intensity so much that you could survive it. If you moved up a few levels, it would be so intense you'd melt into it. You wouldn't survive independently. Spiritually?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Not exactly. Well, what I'm going to try and work out for you this evening is you're on 100% the right track. What I want to work out for you this evening together is how the physical analogy is an exact reflection of that spiritual system. I want to try and show you how the seven colors of the spectrum, right, in the physical world are exactly a reflection of the spiritual reality. It's not just a poetic sort of comparison. Are you with me? It has to be that way. If you ever thought that the spectrum of light has seven colors, it's an infinite gradation, but there's seven clear areas, right? The seven notes in the musical scale. There's seven notes in the musical scale that we use. The eighth is the same as the first. Correct? The frequencies of sound, the mathematical relationship of the seven notes in the scale are the same as the mathematical relationship of the wavelengths of light that make up the spectrum. The way the seven notes interact to form combinations, harmonics, resonances, melody, harmony, is exactly the same as the way light works. Aren't you aware of that? There are three primary colors. And in notes you have tonic, dominant and subdominant notes. And they combine in the same ways. The three primary colors are used to form secondary colors, and out of that you get your whole gradation, your whole music. It works the same. Anybody who thinks that, you know, the world just bumped into itself, you know, after a few million years it just sort of worked out the same, needs a head read. That's why the Kabbalists say that the explicit world is always based on these seven things. Are you with me? It's remarkable, amazing. Except that light, if you... light is a higher analogy than sound. Right? It's a modality that comes higher than sound, and therefore it has extra clues in it. There's an absolute speed involved, which sound doesn't have. Sound is dependent on a medium, light isn't. And the Kabbalists point out other things also, is that, for example, if you mix light in light, unbelievable. If you mix light in light, not in pigment, are you with me? If you mix light, then all the colors together, all the primaries give you white, which is the perfect analogy of the spiritual source. If you mix all colors in pigment, you get mud or black, which is remarkable, because actually pigment is the reflection of light. There's no reason it should be different. You understand that? I don't blame you. You don't understand the physical phenomenon.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't either, for sure.
I understand what you're saying.
I understand what I'm saying. Don't worry, I don't either. I mean it. But the look, you want to talk about the machzor or tshuva, we could do that.
No, I'd rather get this
clear. Get this clear, okay. If you shine the three primary colors of light on a white wall, or all seven colors for that matter, you get white light. It's actually remarkable. If you've ever been to a science exhibition or something where they do it, it's remarkable. You shine the three primary colors together, where the spot focuses, it's pure white. You don't see the red and the green at all, it's pure white. But if you take pigment, you take paint of those colors and mix them, you don't get white paint. You get earth color. You get the color of Malchus, the color of the world, of the earth. Now that's remarkable. Each molecule of paint is reflecting the light the same as the light is. So how come when you mix them together and you see them all shining at you, it doesn't reflect white? It's a remarkable mystery, isn't it? Fantastic, isn't it? But the idea is this: when you shine the medium pure, light pure, it's white. When you attach it to a physical medium, so then it gives you the earth color. The same combination is capable of giving you the highest and access to the highest revelation, and it's capable of giving you the tangible reality of earth. Are you going to hold this against me because Sunday night's not supposed to be mystical? I'm not offended. We're supposed to talk about what you want. So, So stay with me, okay? So now we have like this, that everything you see in the world, let's lay down the principle, everything you see in the world is a concrete version of something spiritual, and the reason that it's here is because since that spiritual reality is so, therefore it projects itself into the physical medium in physical terms. Why it is because you can't function in a physical medium with spiritual reality. How are you going to get a hold of it? How are you going to manipulate and move spiritual reality? You want to move your mind, right? You want to become something different in your mind. You want to develop. You want a relationship between you and someone else to develop. What you really want to develop is not the same element that what gorillas do in the jungle. What you want to develop is the inner aspect of the relationship. It's what's inside you. What's in the spiritual world that's electric between two people. So how are you going to get there? Where's your access to that world? Where are the fuses? Where are the switches? How are you going to switch that on? The answer is through the body. It's remarkable. Other religions of the world have a completely different view of this in the West. They believe that you have to completely divorce yourself from the body in order to get into the spiritual. And our teaching is that you can't possibly reach the spiritual unless you have the handle to turn in the physical. Are you with me? So we do everything through the body. Because our understanding is that the body, the physical world, the tangible, finite, crude, temporal, physical world that's subject to disintegration, that's the only access you have to the spiritual world. It's incredible. An analogy would be, are we together? If you want to become sensitive, let's say, you want to become generous, let's say. So you can sit all day in your house thinking about being generous, it won't make you generous. What you've got to do is get out there and start giving. Whether you feel like it or not. If you want to be generous, start giving. Never mind working on yourself. If you want to become kind or sensitive or gentle, start doing that. That's all. Never mind what it feels like or what you want or not. Just do it. After a short time, the handle of the body will start moving the inner reality. That's called achitzenius mo'ereres es apnimius. The externality awakens the internality. Are we together? There's no other way. Yes, other spiritual systems, they think that you work on the internal dimension, automatically the external will respond. Not like that at all. Not at all like that. This is so practical, by the way, if you want to know, apart from Kabbalistic, the Jewish psychiatry from a Jewish point of view. How do you stop someone being depressed? What's the therapy for depression from a Torah point of view? You know, there's no therapy. Just get him busy. Get the person busy. Get them active. To try and psychoanalyze the person, yes, to try and start, take somebody who's depressed and start working out what happened the way his father looked at him when he was three, you're driving bananas that way. You really need a psychiatrist after that. That's not how you make somebody not depressed. What you do when someone's depressed is you get them busy. They know that, by the way. They give them occupational therapy. People are badly depressed. They get them making baskets with their hands. That's not enough, but it's something. If you want to lift yourself and get moving, you can't do it by getting your head right. Are we together? Get yourself moving, stir those muscles and get things flowing, and then the depression will lift. There's a much deeper root to depression that's not in our subject, and you have to get yourself moving spiritually to really cure depression. Depression really is the result of non-movement spiritually. When a person's not growing spiritually, the necessary outcome is depression. But tonight we're not on that. That's not our subject. So that's the principle. So understand again, the physical world condenses into what it is because the spiritual root is that way. So when it gets filtered by all the filters, it looks like this at the end of the day. And the reason for it is to turn it all back. It's to start moving it here in the physical so that the root changes. It's all interconnected. It's like the genes are a certain way, so the body looks that way. But then there's a new Kiddush to it. If you move the body, you start affecting the genes. You change your spiritual reality. Once you've got a new spiritual reality, it comes down to the physical world different. Once you use that differently, it goes back and affects your spiritual core. Are you with me? There's a myriad applications. Every application, everything there is an application of this. People who are righteous, tzaddikim, people who work on themselves, become very spiritual. So after they die, their bodies don't decompose. You know, that's well recorded. It's not just stories. And I know people who've been involved in such cases, many, many years after being buried, their bodies don't decay at all. The Gemara's got a story of Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon. He wasn't buried for 18 years, at least 18 years. His wife kept him in the house. They couldn't bury him for certain reasons. After 18 years, when a hair fell out of his head, it used to bleed. Right? Completely intact. A lady in this community told me some time ago, a lady who lives here, told me that they had to exhume her father to move him to Israel. 20-something years after he was buried. He's a very special man. He's well known to be exceptional individual. Chevra Kedisha asked her, you don't mind if it sounds a bit gruesome, but they asked her if they minded if just for the transport to ship the body on the plane, if they put the remains into a very small, they put all the remains in a very small container because it's more practical. So she said no, she didn't mind. They couldn't put the remains in a container. He was perfect. Absolutely perfectly intact. Completely, absolutely intact. People who were involved with the Gaon of Vilna say that when they opened his kever after many, many years, the water of the Tyre was still on his beard. The water that they pour on one to clean the body after the person dies. Huh? The water was still... Anyway. It comes down from the spiritual world and affects the body. You have to be very, very special to actually see the glow in this world, because the whole point of this world is that it's within the dark side. But you can know it yourself, although it may not glow outwardly. How does it work? Let's try and understand this area. So you have, look at the mitzvahs, for example. It's a remarkable thing, a remarkable aspect of Torah. Yeah, study any religion in the world you like, and you'll find that a large part of the religion, especially the more spiritual type of, like Eastern religions, for example, you'll find that the work in those religions, in those systems, and there's a lot of truth in them. I'm talking about the true aspects. The work that you'll find there is spiritual work. It's meditation, it's work of prayer, right? Very often it involves asceticism, celibacy, those kind of things. There's tremendous spiritual work. If you look in Judaism, the work's all physical. Of the 613 mitzvahs, I think you can count the mitzvahs on one hand that are not done with the body. One hand, maybe, certainly two. There are very few mitzvahs that are done with the mind. Avas Hashem, to love Hashem, Yiras Hashem, fear of Hashem. You have to remember certain things all the time. There's a handful of mitzvahs that you do with your mind. Isn't that amazing? What you're trying to affect is the spiritual world, and the Torah says, okay, take your hand, do this with your hand, do this with your foot, do this with your mouth, eat this, do this, touch, give, sit, move, lie down. You sit in a sukkah, you put your body in a sukkah. Remarkable thing, each part of the body's got a mitzvah. Each part of the body. Isn't that remarkable? You're working in a spiritual system here. The mitzvah, you know, the root of the word mitzvah is tzavta. Tzavta means togetherness. It means the physical together with the spiritual. It means you and Hashem being together. Mitzvah means tzevet. The Hebrew word tzevet means a crew. People who work together. It means togetherness. Tzevet. Tzevet. Right? Mitzvah is the same root. It means to be together. So when you want to be together with Hashem, what do? You don't elevate and transcend and meditate. You get busy with your hands, with your feet, with your mouth. Remarkable thing. Why is it? The spiritual idea is that what you're doing is you're moving. I'll give you an analogy. It's like if you have an engine and you have to start that engine going. So how do? You turn the handle. You know those old cars? They had like a crank in the front. Yes? My car needs one of those sometimes. You got like a crank in the front. And what happens is when you turn that handle, then the whole thing starts moving. The handle's a piece of metal. The least valuable part of the whole system is that handle. It's the least specialized, it's just a piece of metal. Are you with me? There's nothing moves without it. It's the least important. In fact, when the whole thing's going, you throw it away. It's a beautiful analogy then, isn't it? I just thought of it. What happens, isn't that nice? What happens in the physical world is, it's expendable. The least important part of the whole system is that physical reality, but you can't move anything without it. Are we together? Amazing. I once had a Rebbe who said, Swabi Rebbe, said that the analogy he gave, it's like a person playing the piano. When someone plays the piano, you watch a musician playing, if you're unschooled in music, you see that these keys are moving, and you see that when the keys hit, the note comes out. So you think the key makes the music, but it's not so. The key is connected to a lever, that's connected to something else. There's a lot of connections before something happens, and the music happens deep inside, far away from where you can see it. But you can't get there unless you hit the key. You can't climb in there. You follow what's happening. In other words, that's what's happening. When you see a man doing a mitzvah, you see somebody with a few strings on his garment. That's what he's doing. That's what he's got over here. You be so cool. If you think that this is silly, because it's just a tangible piece of reality, how does this affect the spiritual world? It's no different than those little white ivories, got no music in them. The person took them apart and started to examine the ivory, they wouldn't find any music there. I mean, you must know the famous joke about the... Huh? It sounds like you know it. the primitive tribal individual who was taken off to the new world for a visit. And he went into a house, he came from a hut somewhere in the bush, and was taken into a house where they had running water. You know this thing? Don't you know this thing? So he decided, it's incredible, he opened this tap and the water comes out. So he took back with him and went back a whole box of taps. Huh? And he put the taps in the wall of the hut. And I think he put light bulbs also. You see, because, you follow me? But that won't work. What it's connected to is where it all happens, this way and that way. The handle moves it there, and the tap is the outflow here. It won't work without the tap. That's the beauty of this world. The incredible beauty of this world. Jews haven't survived because they forget about this world. They live in a higher world. Jews appreciate incredibly the beauty of this world. What's beautiful about this world is that it's worth no more than a piece of metal that cranks a handle. And it's discarded afterwards. And it rusts and it disintegrates and it's nothing. But it moves everything. What you want is the root. You want the engine. But you must turn the handle. Are we together? So the way Hashem does it, he says, never mind the spiritual world, just do the mitzvah. Take your hand and do this. Right? Have a bris, circumcision. Never mind what's happening spiritually, I'll take care of that. You just turn the handle. If you think about it, you'll see that. If you think I'm being a bit imaginative, if you think about it, even in human terms, you'll see that's the only way to understand the world. When you make a relationship between two people, only the body does it. Only the body does it. Isn't that right? When you need to say, let's say you want the person to understand something deep about you, right? Something very, very sensitive and personal about you, what do? You tell them something, right? Or you show something, you give something, or you say a word, or you what are you doing really? You're taking a few muscles and twitching them. No different than a monkey, isn't that right? You're giving and give that person something, or you smile. You know, if you're a physicist and you analyze what's happening, it's ridiculous. There's a few nerve impulses jumping around, there's a few muscles twitching, and you reshape the skin of your face, basically. But that's what you're doing, right? Correct? But what happens is a spiritual experience. In fact, it's so deeply ingrained in you that all you feel is the spiritual experience. The last thing you're thinking about, if you have a sensitive moment with your wife, and what you're thinking about is, the muscles and there's something wrong with you. But it can't happen without the medium. The Kuzari goes into the whole thing of how a child is born. A human being. If someone had to ask you how to bring a new neshama into the world, if you had to design the system, you wouldn't have got physical about it. It's too holy for that. A whole person, a human being. But it takes a body. It's absurd. Because I can't go into detail now, unfortunately. That's another time. No other time. The point is that it's absurd. It's crazy. But that's the message. The message is, there's much more detail also, which is not the forum. That's how it is. The lowest part of the physical world, the part of the least value in its own right, the part that's most likely to mislead you into thinking that it's not what it really is. That's what's needed to turn the highest. The further down is turning the highest up. Let's try and apply this idea. The Nefesh HaChaim, the whole book is written on this. The central idea of the Nefesh HaChaim is all based on this, and that's been called the central work of Jewish philosophy. Everybody should study that. The Derech Hashem writes about it. He's got a section there which you can read in English, by the way. Derech Hashem, I think there are copies here. You can read Derech Hashem, the way of God, right? That's by the Lutzato. That's been translated, and you can read the translation. He's got a section there on what he calls Koiches Nivdalim, Kochot Nivdalim. In English, you translate that roughly as transcendent forces. They translated there in the book as transcendental forces. Just everything here has a force one level above it that's abstract that you can't see, but it's the real level, if you like, of this thing that's manifest in the finite world. let's take one or two examples, and I'll share with you one of the most beautiful, beautiful insights. I heard this. I'll just give you an application. It explains so many things. This view of things. After you've heard it, really, you wonder how you could have thought differently, right? No? It's the essence of the spiritual world. That's why it's a big mistake to try and see the spiritual world. We don't do that. You have to look in the physical world if you want to see the spiritual. You have to look in the physical. Yeah, and not. People think if you meditate on a tree long enough, If you meditate on a tree and see something else, then you're having trouble. You're having problems. Meditating on a tree will never show you anything other than a tree. Right? But that's not the point. The point is that what you have to understand is it's a condensation of something. Let me share with you a most wonderful, wonderful idea. I heard this from the late Rabbi Lappin, the Rabbi H. Lappin. I heard this in a recording. I didn't hear him say this personally. But it's a most fantastic idea. I mean, you'll see this idea everywhere. An example he gave was like this. He said, I'm going to tell you the way I heard it exactly, because there's so many things to be learned from this. It's like, it's definitely worth coming here this evening just to hear this idea. No question about it. The more you think about it, the more you'll get out of this. It was a tap on an entirely different subject, but it was worth hearing just this idea alone. He said when he was young, he was in Tel's Yeshiva in Europe. And he used to sit with a group of others. He used to sit with the Tel Zeror. And he used to sit with this great man, and they used to speak to him, and he would tell them if they were saying correct or not correct. He would criticize, comment. He would, right, they would try the ideas on him, and they would have time with him, and he would shape them, guide them. So he said once he was speaking to the Tel Zeror, and he said the following thing. He mentioned the Medrash. Actually, it's a place in Chumash. Rashi brings the Chazal. It says this. That when Moshe Rabbeinu had to do the plagues, right, all the things that he had to do, he did, right? He held out his hand, he held out his staff, he did whatever action it was, and the plague occurred. But when it came to changing the Nile to blood, the water into blood, and when it came to making lice from the earth, from the dust, he couldn't do those. He didn't do them. I don't know if you remember. He didn't do them. Aaron had to do them. His brother did them. And the Rashi says over there, why not? Because he had gratitude. He had that sensitive Jewish midah of Hakaras HaTov, appreciating goodness that had been done to him by these two things. Because when he was a little boy, he was hidden by the river. He was saved by the Nile. Yes, he floated in a little basket, and he was saved by the waters of the Nile. And later, when he had to kill an Egyptian, the Egyptian was hidden in the sand, and it gave him enough time to get away. So the waters of the Nile and the dust of the earth had saved his life twice. And therefore, he couldn't do a plague, right, that would change them into some unnatural form, make lice out of the earth, or make blood out of the water. You follow? And I think the Gemara says on that, you shouldn't throw a stone into a well from which you once drank. If you drank from a well, you shouldn't close up that well. You shouldn't throw a stone into the well if you drank water from that well once. Fair enough? So he said he was explaining this to the Rav, he was mentioning it, and the way he explained it was, what an incredible level of Hakaras HaTov, of sensitivity. It's the epitome of gratitude. The Jewish quality of really appreciating something that was done for you is that even for an inanimate object, he couldn't bring himself to do something like that. And that's the way it's explained usually. That's why, if you look in children's books, you look in that Rashi and the way people explain, that's what they say. They explain to children, even though the dust cannot feel, even though the water is inanimate, but your gratitude should be so that you should even be hesitant, right? When he said that, the Rav said to him, it's not true. It's not true. You're not saying truth. You're not saying anything. It's not right. So he said, why not? So he said, because I hear in your words, listen to this, very, very, very beautiful. I hear in your words that you are ascribing human feelings to the dust and to the water. The way you're saying it is as if to say, there's something in the water, there's something in the dust that sort of could be sensitive to how a human being behaves, and therefore you shouldn't do it because, like, you'd go against some. But that's nonsense. The water doesn't feel anything. Water doesn't feel anything. Dust doesn't feel anything. It would make absolutely no difference. The waters of the Nile once hit you, I promise you, if you turn that water into blood, the water doesn't react and it's got no feelings at all. Can you hear what's going on? In other words, there doesn't say any place in Torah that water's got feelings. No matter how sensitive you are, water doesn't have feelings. There's no mitzvah to take care of the feelings of water or to be considerate with the dust, you know, in case you hurt it. No matter how sensitive you are. Are we together? In other words, like you're in a fairy story world here. You're fairy stories, this. You know, where animals speak and you're not saying truth. Can you hear that? It's beautiful. So he said he suddenly realized it wasn't right. So he asked the Rav, what is chet? What does it mean? If the water doesn't feel anything, or the dust doesn't feel anything, so why couldn't he change them into what he had? It was a big mitzvah to save the Jewish people and teach the Egyptians and part of Torah. So I said to him, you find out, which is the mark of a great teacher. The mark of a great teacher is not to just fill you with the answer. The great teacher will... You want to go and work it out? So he said he discovered the answer. Short time later, he heard a certain shir or he saw a certain medrash, I don't remember, and there he found the answer. And I'll tell you, first of all, at this point, you've already learned something great. You can't just say a pshat, you can't just say something that you think makes sense, even if you think you're reading the words, you can't do it. Torah has to be true. It has to fit, it has to be perfect. There's nothing in Torah that's fitted in with a crowbar. You know, if you've got to squeeze it in like that, you're not saying true. So what is the meaning of this chazal? The words still have to say what they say. But the meaning has to be true. You can't start saying that the words are going to feel bad. And if the water's not going to feel bad, then the man's an idiot. The person's an idiot if he starts worrying about the feelings of water. You know, the psychiatrist will tell you you're an obsessive, you're neurotic. Start worrying about the water and the dust. That's inhuman. So he said this. Listen to this greatness. How did he learn the answer to this question? Listen to where he found it. He found it here. He was once, I don't know if you heard a shir on this or he read it. There's a chazal, I think it's a gemara. Gemara says like this. There was a certain, I think it was a Tana Rebbe Elazar, if I'm not mistaken. But one of the great personalities of the Talmud came one day Friday, he had nothing to eat for Shabbos. He and his wife had nothing to eat at all. Okay, they were out of everything. So his wife, you know, they looked at each other. There was nothing to make. There was no Shabbos food. That was it. Friday, nothing to make. So he went out into the fields and he davened to Hashem to help him. What is a person going to do in that situation? You want to go begging? You have any money? So he went out into the field and he davened to Hashem. And a precious stone came down from Shemayim. A priceless, very, very expensive gem, right, was given to him. So he went into the marketplace and he sold it. And he bought a fortune of beautiful things for Shabbos and he brought them up. So his wife said, where did you get all this? So he hummed and hawed. His wife said, look, if you don't tell me where this came from, I'm not tasting anything. So he told his wife, look, I'll tell you what happened. We didn't have anything. What was I supposed to do? I went out and I asked Hashem to help. I had faith that he'd help and he helped. Sent down a precious gem and I sold this and I bought all this. So his wife said like this. Listen to this. Great woman. You have to understand also the sensitivity of a woman over here. She said to him, do you want to get to the next world and find that everyone around you has got full tables and yours is lacking? One version of the Midrash says that you'll see that everybody else's table has four legs and yours only has three. In other words, listen well what she was explaining. What she was explaining to her husband was, there's nothing given for free in this world. If something comes down miraculously from this world, you pay for it there. There's a repository, there's a store, there's a reservoir of spiritual goodness, right? There's another world of value that you're building. Everything you suffer here and everything you work on here builds a different world over there. If you get given something from there while you're here and you don't have it there, you know, there are rules. You follow me? There are rules. I think Rabbi Yochanan was once walking past Nachal Kidron, I think it says, and they were starving, he and his students. And they must have mentioned it to him. So he did something, and the valley was filled with gold. Or all the trees in the valley, I think, were all filled with gold. They couldn't believe it. Kabbalistically, that's nothing. To produce a few bits of gold, Kabbalistically, is nothing. They were overjoyed. So he said to him, but I just want to warn you. Anything you take from here, you won't have there. They left it. So she explained that to him. She said to him, okay, she said to him, you can use it here, but if we taste this food over here, we're eating up the reality of that those goods in the world to come. There's no free handouts over here. It's up to you. You can have it here and destroy it, use it and finish it off, or you can save it. So it says he went back, and I think what happened was he sold it and he bought the stone again, and he went into the fields and he threw it up and it was taken. And I think it says in one place in Chazal that miracle was even greater than the first one, because Shemayim, when they give, they don't take back. But anyway, that's what happened. Now the question is like this. That's a famous chazal, it's a famous story. All children know that story. All children who know it.
But didn't the rabbi know that if he gets now, then he won't?
His wife knew more. Yes, he must have known, but I don't know. Yeah, you have to understand here exactly what was the debate between them. He also was a very, very great man.
If you got from Shammai, I'm sure he's a great man.
Yeah, so that proves to you. And still his wife understood more and he knew she was right. He went to give it back. Anyway, it's a fascinating chazal. The point is this, what do you learn? You learn that it's all the same thing. You can't have it here and there. And that's why we go through all the sufferings and difficulties that we go through in this world. Each of them, and the worse it is building more for you over there. Okay. So Rabbi Lapin said the following thing. When he thought about this, and he suddenly asked himself, excuse me, one second. It's apparent from this story that what's waiting on your table in the next world, that's the way it says, you're sitting at a table. And it's all laid out for you. What's waiting on your table there could be given to you here. And then he said, but one second, there are no precious stones up there. There's no precious stones up there. That's a world of spirituality. The last thing you need up there is precious stones. What are you going to do with it up there? You're in a world without a body. Right? You're in a world with only spiritual reality. The last thing you need is, all you want up there is the spiritual light. The last thing you need is bits of glass. What's going on? If they take something from there, and it's so much clear that it's from there, that if you use it here, you won't have it there. It's the same thing. So what I should get here is something miraculous. I should get something spiritual, something... But a gem? Something physical? But the answer is obvious. The answer is obvious. The answer is this. Of course in the next world it's not a precious stone. Of course it's spiritual up there. But when it gets given from there to here, it changes form. It changes form. As you go through the levels, what happens is it condenses. It changes into the currency that's valid at the level that it's been given. Had he been given something spiritual here, he couldn't have eaten that for Shabbos. What was he going to do with something spiritual in this world? First of all, you can't fit it in. The smallest piece in the next world, you can't fit into the whole of this world. It's just completely incompatible. You can't get it in here. What happens is this. They take something from the spiritual world, and they pass it down through the barrier that leads to this world. And as it passes the barrier, it translates into the currency that's applicable here. Are you with me? Obviously. So you suddenly... can you feel that? Must be, no? It must be. It costs the same. That means it is that precious stone here. It is the very same thing as what was on his table there. But it looks very different. Each time it changes, goes through the exchange control, you know, then it changes currency. But it's worth exactly the same. If you take your rands and make dollars out of them, you don't have the rands anymore. Yeah, but you need dollars when you get that size. And you need rands. Are you with me? It's obvious, right? So he said he understood from this a very, very wonderful secret. And it stood like this. Whatever manifests here is just this version, manifestation of what the source is. In the source, it's something different. And of course, the source has a source, and that's something different also. And that source has a source. And if you go all the way to the source of the... It's Hashem, obviously. Which is what we're discussing this evening, right? Now let's go back to the problem. So why couldn't he hit the water? Or why couldn't he hit the dust? Why couldn't he turn the dust into Kinim? Like this. He said that... But Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want to change the water into blood because he had a feeling of gratitude towards the water. He wasn't worried about the water. He was worried about the source. A person of greatness, I don't know if you understand what you just heard here. It's wonderful. When I heard this, such a beautiful insight. A person like Moshe Rabbeinu's level is not psychotically worrying about the feelings of the water. An intelligent 10-year-old is not going to do that. What he's concerned about is the root. What saved his life? The waters of the Nile. But there's a root controlling that. And there's a root of that. What actually saved his life was Hashem. Working through the channel called the Nile River. Working through the channel called the dust of the earth. It's an emanation. It's just a translation of that root into a version that manifests at this level. Like, are you with me? The gratitude you feel, not to the dust, that's nonsense. But there's a genuine gratitude that you feel to the root of it, which is really where it came from. But it's obvious when you hear it, isn't it? So the reason he can't change the water into blood, or change the dust into lies, into kirim, is because he knows that this was a channel that was used by Hashem to save him. And that in appreciation of every manifestation of the source, he can't bring himself to act against that manifestation. But he's focusing on the root. A person of greatness is always thinking of the root. He's always moving the handle here, but he's always thinking of the machine inside. Of course, it's hard to explain this to a six-year-old. When you read that Rashi, Chumash, and you teach a child that, you know, we must have gratitude. He's saved by the water. He shouldn't do something hurtful to the water. The child can only understand. The child can only read. You know, the childhood level. Which is fine, the Torah is true at that level. There is a problem with hurting feelings here. But it's the root level, it's the reality. As a child gets older, they'll understand the difference. The marvelous thing about Torah, the remarkable thing, there's much more to say about it. Maybe we'll just stop at this point and see if there are any questions. But the remarkable thing about Torah is that, the incredible thing about it is that the explicit level of Torah carries within all the other levels. The explicit level, if you get a handle on that, you know everything else is moving. You may not have the faintest clue about how the machine works, or how the little hammers and springs are all connected to get the music out of the piano, but if you hit the note, or you turn the handle, it will happen. It's wired up in such a way, Hashem's taking care of it, it's been wired in such a way. And by the way, it's one of the reasons that we don't focus on Kabbalah. It's one of the reasons we don't focus on Kabbalistic wisdom, because it's all wired up automatically, and it's functioning behind the scenes anyway. Just do the mitzvah here. Just go out and do the action that you have to do here, and all the current will flow, the life will come on. There's an incredible explanation of this. The Gaon of Vilna says like this. There's a place in Mishlei, there's a verse in Mishlei that says this. It says, "Bechol drachecha da'ehu, know him in all your ways, v'hu yiyasher orchosecha, and he will straighten out your pathways." That's a very interesting verse. Listen carefully. The verse says like this. Mishlei is Proverbs, what's called Proverbs in English. It says like this. "Bechol drachecha da'ehu, in all your ways know him," means know Hashem. "The who and he, Hashem, yiyasher orchosecha, will straighten out your pathways." What does this mean? One of the remarkable things about the verse is that it changes the words. First it says, "Bechol drachecha," on all your roads, your main road. Derech is like a main road. And then at the end of the verse it says, "And he will straighten out," not your main roads, "orchosecha." Orchosecha means your little pathways. Why did it change from roads to pathways? The God of Vilna explains like this. Very, very beautiful, unbelievable chat. This is a real Kabbalistic chat. Listen to this. But it's a Kabbalistic chat that explains why you shouldn't go into Kabbalistic secrets. Unbelievable. Like this, listen to this. "Bechol drachecha," says the Gaon of Vilna, "derech," the word derech means main roads. It means the main explicit highways. So the commandment is to know Hashem in all the main roads. The openly revealed, open, wide open spaces of Torah that you can read openly. "Bechol drachecha da'ayu," your job is to know Hashem in all the revealed part of the Torah. "V'hu yiyasher orchosecha," what will happen is he will fix up and straighten out your little side hidden paths. Orchosecha is pathways that only an individual can take. The secret hidden pathways through the forests, that's orchosecha. You follow? So what the verse is saying is, you never mind about the little pathways. You'll get lost over there. It's dangerous. You keep to the highway and do it properly, and Hashem will take care of all the side paths. Beautiful. So the Gaon explains like this. Look carefully at the words. You'll see it. "Bechol drachecha da'ehu." The word da'ehu in Hebrew is spelled dalet, ayin, heivav, which literally means da, which means no, him, heivav. So the Gaon says like this, unbelievable. Heivav means in Hebrew the five books of Chumash, hey is five, and vav is six. The five books of the Chumash, the openly written part, biblical, openly revealed part of it. Da ehu, da no, heivav, the five books of Chumash, and the six sages of the Mishnah. "V'hu yiyasher," and he, Hashem, will straighten out your pathways. How do you spell who? Hey, vav, aleph. Hey, the five books of Chumash. Vav, the six orders of the Mishnah. And the silent aleph, which is the oneness of Kabbalistic depth that is in everything that you don't hear. It's silent. That secretly comes along and fixes up. You follow? Because da'ehu is spelled hey, vav. But then the second part of the verse that says that he will help you, that is spelled hey, vav, aleph. Silently and secretly slipped into that part of the pasuk is a secret and silent aleph that just somehow automatically you follow. In other words, the message of this verse, you actually read it in the letters themselves actually teach that. And that's of course why people who understand about Torah, they never, the older they get, the more emphasis they put on the explicit meaning. The way they say a person should learn Torah is that when he's young, when he's 6 years old, 5 years old, you read Chumash. Chumash, Hashem created the world. Moshe Rabbeinu went up the mountain. What did it mean to a 6 year old? Sees a picture in front of his eyes. You try to explain to him abstraction, he wonder what you're talking about. When he's 76 years old, and he's been through all the Kabbalistic depth, and he's been through all the hidden levels of Torah, then he understands what the simple menu really means. He couldn't understand it in the beginning. The Chofetz Chaim used to say, you know, there's four levels to Torah. I'm nearly finished. There are four levels to Torah. What's called pshat, that means the revealed meaning of the words, whatever the words say. If it's, excuse me? Pardes. Pardes. Shat, remez, drush, and sod. Pardes means the orchard. When it says a person goes into the orchard, it's poetically saying a person goes into Torah. Shat is the simple meaning. Remez is the hinted level. analogies, right? Allegory. Drush is a much deeper level that's brought out of the depth, and so is the secret level, the Kabbalistic level. Paradise, it spells Pei, Reish, Dalet, Salam, right? Paradise, you go into the orchard. The Gaon used to say that Paradise is really, it doesn't really go Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sosh. It doesn't go like that. First level is the level of hinting. The second is the level of Drush. The third is Sod, and the fourth is the simple meaning. Only we don't say it that way, because you can't start giving a person a hint until you've told him the simple meaning. You don't want to tell him the simple thing, you want to tell him the deeper thing, but you can't tell him the deeper until you've told him the simple thing. Again, when you take a six-year-old, you're not interested in telling a six-year-old that we wandered around in the desert. Who cares? So there were some people who trudged around in the sand for 40 years, so no. That's not what you want. What you want him to understand is the spiritual depth of it, what it means. But you can't start giving somebody a hint unless you've established the code first. Are you with me? When two spies have to give a message, and they tell each other a story about what they had for dinner last night, and meantime they're speaking in code. The last thing they care about is what they had for dinner last night. They're not thinking of that. But you can't start telling them the secrets until you've agreed on the code. Are you with me? So you take a five-year-old, the last thing you're interested in telling him is the physical meaning of Torah. Torah is not physical. But first you teach him the physical word. So then, once he's got that, you start teaching. And by the time you've been through the whole thing, then he understands what you were trying to tell him when he was 6 years old. The Chofetz Chaim, when he was in his, like, 80s, people say they used to see him. People say they used to look through the keyhole, I don't know. They used to spy on him, and they used to see the sage, right, the greatest man in the Jewish nation, 80 years old. He would be learning Chumash like a 6-year-old. In private, he would try and learn Chumash with excitement of a 6-year-old. And people say that he used to get excited like a child. He used to read the Makkos, the plagues in Egypt, and he would say, good for him, good for him. You know, give it to them, Hashem. You know, they deserve it. And he wasn't playing games. He was trying to feel. Huh? I mentioned here on Tuesday, the famous Mashgiach of Mir. Incredible, incredible, sage, saintly individual, one of the deepest minds of this generation. I heard from my Rosh Kodal that once they went to Yeshiva, and he had a room that overlooked the Beis Medrash. There was like a balustrade, and on the second floor, his private room overlooked the Beis Medrash. Once they were in the Beis Medrash, and they heard the most incredible noise, they thought a bomb had gone off in his room. So the Bochim ran upstairs, and they found the Mashgiach buried under a pile of shtenders. You know these heavy lecterns? Heavy wooden shtenders, right? He was buried under a pile. Fortunately, he wasn't hurt. What had happened? Just hear this. He had carried the shtenders upstairs from the yeshivas, old man. And he piled them in two rows to the ceiling. He piled these heavy shtenders, one on top of the other. He wanted to feel what Kriyas Yam Suf was like. He wanted to feel what it was like going through the waters. When the sea split, he wanted to get a feeling of what it was like. Never mind the Kabbalistic meaning and all the depth and everything else and what was happening in spiritual world. He wanted to just feel, to give anything to feel what those Jews felt. So he was walking between these and the shtenders collapsed on him. But I mean, you know. Yeah, any questions? We just began the subject, but any questions so far? Yes, please.
But the other plagues, wasn't there any sensitivity back to the same source?
But it wasn't something that he benefited from directly.
It
was the same source. But a different channel. The gratitude, misunderstand here. The gratitude, the message here, is that we don't disregard the channel. Yeah? Let me give you an analogy. When a man and woman love each other very much, and they've built up many years of a special relationship, the articles of the relationship, the places that they were in together, the things that they did, they bear special significance. Not because they gone soft in the brain, that they're now keeping it as a keepsake. Are you with me? It's because of what it means, but there's meaning invested in that thing. Are you with me? I don't know if you're of a sentimental turn of mind, but you'll go and you'll find people keep things. Yes? There's some people who take their baby's first shoe, and I keep it on the mantel place for the next 65 years. Every time that child comes, he's now a professor of nuclear physics or something. When he visits the house, he's, you know, has to tell his friends, well, you know, that little tacky, you know, is what he looks at. Why do they do that? Parents aren't feeble-minded. They don't think there's anything special about that. But it evokes. Are you with me? But it has to be done through the channel. What they're really focusing on is the relationship and the person. But the channel is special. And it has tremendous power. Are you with me? Moshe Rabbeinu's sensitivity to appreciate what Hashem did for him in this way and what Hashem did in that way. And you follow, that's the point. Sure, the source is all the same.
But the point is that it manifests in all these different ways, and the sensitivity is that way. Remarkable, yeah.
The world is set up that the spiritual world has to be turned on by the physical. My question, I'm not sure if the question is, why would I turn the world on
that? The deepest level of your question, it is the question. The deepest level of your question, we certainly can't answer. The deepest level, why he does anything, in that final analysis, we certainly can't answer. You with me? All we can say is, the deepest level we can approach it is to say this. I mean, the real question is, why did he bother to create a world in the first place? Why wasn't he happy with just being, since he is all perfect already? We can't answer that question. But what the Kabbalists say about it is, but we can observe that he did. So we can say that somehow, spiritually, the essence of truth is that it's not good enough to be able to do something, you have to actually do it. Being potential, the message for us, why he needs it is not our problem. Why he needed this whole thing is his problem, not ours. We're not here to figure that out. We're here to figure out what we're supposed to do. What we're supposed to do is learn from what he does. What we learn from what he does is that being able to bring something into practical reality is not good enough. You have to actually do it. And that's the Kabbalistic answer that we can answer for why is the neshama put into a body? Why are you not left floating around in the spiritual world as a bundle of spiritual energy of potential? Why do you have to come down? You know, it's a tremendous conflict that the neshama gets put into a body. It says that for the neshama, it's the most difficult experience to get put into a finite body. The neshama is infinite, right? It's a spark of infinity. To get put into a physical body that's not smelly, with excrement inside. The most awful experience, the most incredibly awful experience for the neshama. She fights like anything not to be put in. Are you with me? Why does she have to, and philosophically it's a tremendous question, why does Hashem need to take that incredibly beautiful, unlimited spiritual reality and put it into her body? The answer is, because as a spiritual potential, it just is potential, but not actual. It's an architect's ability to design a beautiful building. But that's nothing. It has to be done to be real. And therefore, at the highest level, Hashem is not content just to be what he is. He has to be able to do. He has to actually do. Bring it to limited, finite, practical terms. And he gives you the same role. He takes your incredible power to be able to do. He's not happy with that. He wants you to actually do. And by the way, that's why you have to live your whole life. That's why you can't walk around being able to do. You have to actually do. You have to actually achieve. It's not good enough to be able to say that I'm able to be very sensitive and loving and gentle and kindly. You have to do it. And that's why he challenges you with ordeals all the time. He makes you put it into practice. He gives you a wife that's hard to get on with. Not you, I mean. Yeah, why? Because she brings out, right? Or a wife is incredibly easy to get on with, to bring it out, whatever you need. He gives you all the opportunities so that you can actually make real what you... He's not happy with what you could be. You have to actually be. It's not good enough for Avraham Avinu to be a man who could sacrifice his son. No, I'm not happy with that. He wants him to actually go through it in the world. You with me? Now why he wants all that, we don't know. You follow? That we certainly are, not only I can answer, nobody can. But the beautiful thing about Torah is that the philosophical questions that we can ask, is the fortunate questions we can ask that we can't answer. But all the questions that we can ask that we need to know, we can answer. You follow? What we need to know to do about it, we can answer. Why he needs it, we've no idea. Yes, Chris?
So are you saying that Hashem doesn't share to us for things in this world? From the glory you're telling us with that precious stone?
Like this. You certainly should daven for things you want in this world, but not miraculously. You don't want... The pshat is that if you get it through a miracle, okay, then you should be afraid. If you get it through natural means, and prayer is not considered miraculous. Prayer is considered an absolute rock-bottom natural mechanism. There's another whole discussion why. And you won't get it unless you ask. That's absolutely fine. Even if it's so obvious that it's a response to your two things, incredible coincidences all just get set up, you know, remarkable things that happen to people, but it's still not miraculous. You know, a real cynical skeptic will say, yo, well, coincidentally, you know, in that week this happened to happen and you met this person and that's okay. But if it's clearly miraculous, you're in trouble. When Avraham Avinu was saved in the war of the four kings against the five kings, he went into an international multi-empire war. It was a world war. Five kingdoms against four kingdoms. He waded into war with them to save Lot, his nephew. And he wiped them all out. He had 318 soldiers, according to one opinion. According to one, it was just him and Eliezer. According to another opinion, there were 318 of them. Talmidei Chachamim, they sat and learned Torah. They went out to war, and he was criticized for taking them with him, by the way, for stopping them in their learning. They waded into this world war and they wiped them all out. And the next words Hashem says, Al tira avram, do not be afraid. Tzchacha habemod, your reward is very great. So Mephoshim said, what was he afraid of? He was afraid that because he'd been saved miraculously, there was nothing left there. A miracle of that order happening here costs everything you have there. That's where miracles live. You want to use them here? Credit balance can't take that. So Hashem said, don't worry. You've got it here and I'm taking it for you. That's a bigger miracle. Yeah, we don't dumb for miracles. Ain't simple. We don't rely on miracles, we don't dumb for it. We dumb for naturally. Again, you follow, getting cured from something remarkably impossible to get cured from is not miraculous. I mean, you have to know. Everything's a miracle. You follow me? But to go dumb in that is you just pour into your hands now through the ceiling. No, there's other ways. No, it doesn't have to be that way. Nothing fussy about how. Yeah, one more question. Yes, please.
We speak about the reality of the water cow of the Lama Bath. What is this conclusion that
the handle that cranks that engine, it's not an illusion. Are you with me? That's right. It's much less significant than the machine, than the engine. Any fool can crank it. Not any fool can build that engine. Any fool can turn that piece of metal on the outside. And intrinsically it's of no value. It will be thrown away after it's easy. Are you with me? But it's not an illusion. It's critically important. Those little white things on the piano that you hit, they're not an illusion, but they're nowhere near the music. Are you with me? You don't make a mistake, this world's not an illusion. It can hurt you very badly, this world. And it can make you everything that you have to be, and it's the only place where you can be what you have to be. It's much harder in the other place. What happens after this, to build the same work is incredibly difficult. Over there you have to suffer badly to build the same thing. Are you with me? That's right. The lowest of them all is this. The furthest from the absolute reality. Absolutely, yes. The most, the least spiritual, the most finite, the one given to problems, etc., 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 but not illusion. Are you with me? Yes, please. It's illusion. It's illusory in one way, that if you looked at it from the next level up, you wouldn't see it. It would be so insignificant. But from here, it's everything. Yes, please. It's like saying that two people love each other, right? And now they want to have this great, wonderful spiritual relationship and raise a family. Without bodies that function, can't relate to each other and can't raise a family. Is the body the important thing? Animals do that. Certainly, but it's not an illusion. Are you with me? To be geared in so that the meaning comes out of it. Yes, please. That's what you learn about marriage, by the way. It's a very intimate subject that has to be discussed more fully some other time. Yeah.
Same value
now in the Lama Bath,
just different
form. Ah. So what's the point of having our kidney for them if it's the same
value as now?
It must have
much greater form.
Much greater value. How am I going to explain this to you? Let me understand your question. The problem is the exchange rate. That's your problem. Exchange rate is an exchange of the finite for the infinite. That little piece here, that's got a very finite value here, it expands to a level of infinity over there. Sure, relative to that world, it's only a part of it. But there things are measured. The tiniest piece there could never be fitted in here. The proportion is the same, but the proportion is so mind-boggling that there's no way for us to describe it. All I can do is try to give you another analogy. The smallest mitzvah here. You know, when the Gaon was dying, he was crying. So the student, the Talmidim stood around and they said to him, Rebbe, why are you crying? If anybody's going to a place that... He said, he's not upset. He's upset to be leaving a world so beautiful where for a few pennies you can do a mitzvah. For a few pennies you could buy tzitzis. The Gaon wasn't being sentimental. What he meant was over here, few meager pennies will buy you tzitzis. The value of that is infinite. He's going to a world now where there's no connection to that. For all its beauty and all its incredible power, the currency, the exchange rate is just, it's breathtaking. There's just no, I once heard about Victor Miller say that it's like, by the way, it's the reason why there's no reward for a mitzvah in this world. The reason why there's no reward for a mitzvah in this world is because they just can't fit, the smallest deserved payout for the smallest mitzvah can't fit into the whole of this world. You with me? Your only problem is understanding the exchange rate. Once you understand it, He said like this, it's like a man travelling through the Karoo. He didn't say the Karoo, but I mean, translated in South African terms. And he stops at a little town, one of these little towns, you know, where there's like just, there's like one little building and it's everything. It's the post office and the general store and the bank and everything else, right? He's very thirsty, wants a cool drink. So he walks in there and he's got a check. All he has on him is a check for 10,000 rands. So he walks up to the chap behind the counter and he asks him if he can just change this so he can buy the cold drink. The guy's never seen that much money before in his life. He says, we just can't change. The whole town isn't worth that. He says, I can't help you, but when you get back to where you're going, walk into any bank, I'll change it on the spot. So that's what a mitzvah is. A mitzvah is the kind of currency they just can't change for you over here. They've never seen that kind of value over here. Do you follow me? When you get back where you're going, it's no posh, it's no problem over there. That's what they deal with. You follow? But all the currency they got over here, you know, all the yachts in the Caribbean and all the everything else, right? Doesn't begin to pay. You follow? It's an exponential relationship, it's not okay.